Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
That's almost 52 years so far. The world has become a worse and worse place.
Every year we have polluted more water than the year before.
So Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. I'm Mike Sleva along with the good Dr. Guy McPherson. This January 19th, 2016 edition, episode 73 of Nature Bats Last comes live from two locations in southern New Mexico. Our thanks again to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com. Today we'll have a climate change update, but we begin with our guest interview. Guy?
Yeah, today we are privileged to have with us Sarah Perry. Ms. Perry authored the 2014 book, Every Cradle is a Grave. The book is one of the few to challenge my perspective on the world and is perhaps the most influential book I've read within the last two decades. Published by Nine Banded Books, the subtitle is Rethinking the Ethics of Birth and Suicide. Sarah Perry is a housewife in Nevada. Every Cradle is a Grave is her first book. She also blogs at theviewfromhell.blogspot.com.
Great title.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, Sarah Perry.
Thank you.
Let's start with a little bit of your story. You describe yourself as a housewife. How does a housewife end up writing a book about life itself?
How does anyone write a book? I don't know. How does anyone else have time? I guess my search was for a sort of philosophical reason for human existence and why continue living. And I wasn't finding a lot of answers. I thought Camus has sort of a not very honest answer, in my opinion, his answer to the question of suicide. Thomas Nagel is pretty honest about it. He kind of just admits philosophy doesn't have answers to this. But of course, being human, any kind of interesting question is kind of a reason to live. So finding a sort of interesting, even if pretty depressing answer to various questions ended up being a pretty interesting project. So, over a few years, I wrote about some kind of challenging ideas. The idea that birth or having children may not be a moral good, and that suicide may not be the moral bad that we think it is.
You know, you bring up suicide and natalism. Uh-huh. And your perspective on those two is a little different than the mainstream. In fact, I've seen you come under considerable attack for your countercultural views. Can you tell us about how you respond to those attacks?
I actually, in the past couple of years, I've been surprised not to be attacked that much. Even like right wingers and like Catholic priests are pretty sympathetic to me, and I'm not really sure why. I think it's just because I'm nice. So
maybe I should try that.
That actually works. Huh?
Me. Yeah, people have surprised me with their intellectual openness and just, you know, willingness to listen to any perspective if it's interesting and sincere. And, you know, I'm interested in other things too. I'm studying ritual and how that relates to human psychology and group psychology and the self and stuff like that. So I don't just have this one thing I study. I think I can connect with people through other ideas and not just have this, oh, everything's horrible kind of perspective.
Do you think maybe that the response to you lately is not being as negative is due to the fact that maybe people are seeing the state of the world and seeing, because we talk a great deal about climate change and the effects of climate change and many other issues that are going on. Do you think maybe people are, coming around because, things aren't that great?
Yeah, I think everybody thinks there's a crisis. They may disagree as to what the nature of the crisis is. So, it does seem that, there's a lot of overlap, with thinking that things are that it's a particularly difficult time for humans for different reasons. But yeah, that's one of them.
Okay.
You also, do a lot of scholarship. This book isn't just your opinion about the way the world is. You actually include a lot of evidence rooted in the refereed journal literature. I do that too, but it doesn't seem to stop the hate mail from coming in. Can you talk a little bit about how somebody with a bachelor's degree just dived into this topic and visited the library? I mean, how did you even go about this?
Oh, I read, sometimes I read 1,000 papers a month. I think people, if you have an academic job, I don't know how people find time to keep up with the literature and write with all their administrative committees and classes to teach. I found with philosophy, I think, the British diaspora other than the United States is probably the easiest to read. I think the South African David Benatar is one of my big influences. The Australians, some of the British philosophers themselves. The Americans, I think, tend toward a more technical, difficult style, and that's just the appropriate way to communicate in philosophy in the U.S. But in other countries, it's not as much the case. So. In science journals, I think they tend less toward obfuscation compared to philosophy journals.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of that. In fact, one of my favorite quotes comes from a colleague of mine from many years ago, so long ago I can't remember his name. The primary products of science are confusion, controversy, and publications.
Indeed.
and it seems that most scientific enterprises, maybe every academic discipline, uses obfuscation at some level to let the masses know that we have a language all our own and you aren't invited to play, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the idea of publications being the primary product, this is part of the science system being eaten by universities and government instead of being more of a something driven by private individuals that, yeah, it tends to be, it becomes sort of a bureaucracy with publications as its main product.
Yeah, not just a bureaucracy, but a corporate bureaucracy, because the journal articles, the journals themselves, now are essentially all privately owned by corporations. So there's not much influence that individuals can have over that system as a whole.
Yeah.
Your book is pro-suicide and anti-natalist, so let's discuss those two issues in sequence, and correct me if I'm making the issue.
Yeah, I would say pro-suicide, I think, is funny, but it's more pro-suicide rights, I guess. I don't think anybody should commit suicide, so that's not my take, but that people should have the right to, sure.
Okay, well, thanks for that correction. So.
Yeah.
Regardless, pro-suicide rights is a strong stance in a death-denying culture like ours.
Yeah.
So can you describe the advantages of having suicide rights from the perspective of individuals as well as from societies? There's two big chunks there.
There's a lot of perspectives that this is true from. One of the perspectives, I think, is from people who actually don't want to die. Having the right to suicide, such as having a sort of comfortable option to reliably die if people want to, I think prevents people from being able to signal through making dangerous suicide attempts when they don't really want to die. Because I think a lot of suicide attempts are not sincere. I think there's a lot of confusion, and of course, you know, when people are in a desperate situation, even if they don't want to die, even if they don't want to hurt themselves, it can feel like the only way to get attention or to get sort of cultural resources that they need. Since we have this culture where we always rescue people from suicide attempts, we always, you know, scrape them up and put them in hospital, prison, and people can kind of rely on that. Of course, it's not always the case. I think people do basically die without wanting to from various suicide attempts because they feel like they're safe. So that's my fantasy of rescue argument. And of course, for people who actually do want to die, the methods that are available to people, suicide is technically legal, but it's not really legal. Basically, the only methods that you would ever want someone you love to use are illegal, overdosing on various drugs. Shooting yourself is horrible. Cutting yourself, jumping from a building is an awful thing. Like if someone you loved was in a terrible situation, you know, terminally ill, you wouldn't be like, oh, just jump off a building.
Right.
So for people who really do want to die, I think that's also a benefit. I have this one horrible argument that's so, I like to talk about sacredness, that a lot of my views sort of violate the sacred ideas that we don't necessarily think of as sacred. One interesting fact is that the number of people on the transplant wait list is much smaller than the number of people who commit suicide every year. So if suicide were legal, there would be no transplant wait list. And maybe people wouldn't want to use that because it sort of is a sacredness violation. It's kind of, I don't even want to think about that. But by forcing people to commit suicide alone in their apartments and make sure that they do all the security properly, so it means their organs can't be used, basically. So it's even if they would want their organs to be used. So.
Well, and you bring up in your book that even people who attempt suicide are not always successful, jumping off that tall building, jumping off a bridge.
Yeah.
And then there's the whole issue of the body envelope and bursting that envelope and the cultural response to that.
Almost all horror movies rely on a body envelope violation because it's a universal disgust trigger. Cutting our skin or needles under our skin or anything like that, amputation of limb, anything. Violating the envelope of our skin is a horrible thing that we don't even want. We have a huge psychological reaction to it for a good evolutionary reason. But when we no longer feel that we want to go along with our evolutionary programming, that makes it very difficult.
Well, yeah, I'd say that's one of the more difficult challenges we've ever faced in human history is overcoming our evolutionary instincts, overcoming that genetic built-in response to almost anything. And Nietzsche, late in his career, gave up on the idea of the Superman, the Uberman, because it was so very difficult to overcome our evolutionary programming.
One thing I found really interesting in the past year is how much humans kind of have overcome their evolutionary programming in the what's called the fertility transition since the late 18th century. That right around the late 1700s, right around the American Revolution, the French Revolution, in some parts of New England and France, people started having fewer children, apparently intentionally. And this gradually spread throughout the world. And it happened a lot sooner than people think. People think that people started having fewer children maybe because of child mortality changes, that children started living longer, or maybe because of modern birth control. But it all happened way before that. So we have to say, well, why did that happen? Mostly was accomplished, even among the Mormons, their fertility transition was accomplished by 1900. So really early. I don't know what they're using for birth control. I don't know how they're accomplishing this, but they're down from 8 children per woman to about 4 children per woman in 1900 in the Utah genealogy surveys.
Well, so I look at a lot of people who have children, and they don't seem to be very happy having had children. So maybe some people are actually capable of stopping.
Indeed. And people definitely have been capable of having fewer children and sort of going against their biological urges. I think the most promising explanation is John Caldwell's, which is that it's education, which it sort of makes children more expensive, but not in the sense of economic expense. In the old way of having children, they're sort of just almost servants that you have that expect to work hard and be raised strictly. Modern children who are educated expect to be treated as people, and I think we have a really different relationship with them.
Yeah.
And maybe it's more fulfilling, but that we tend to want to have fewer of them as a result.
Right. I could make a joke here about those children, but I won't, because some people don't think I'm funny.
Yeah.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. We're speaking with author Sarah Perry, who wrote Every Cradle is a Grave. And if you'd like to ask her a question, you can call 1-888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
So I have a similar question with respect to natalism. So pro-suicide rights, like being anti-natalist, maybe that's too strong a term too, is a strong stance in a death-denying culture. So can you describe the advantages from the perspective of individuals and societies of not procreating?
The primary, I call it a troll of my part, the primary strange argument of mine, taken from David Benatar, the South African philosopher I mentioned, is what's called philanthropic antinatalism. So one kind of antinatalism is misanthropic antinatalism, antinatalism, which is the idea that, well, people are horrible, they don't deserve to live anyway, the earth would be better without us. And that's fine. That's not my position. My position is human life is so bad. It's there's so much suffering possible that we shouldn't be bringing innocent children into the world. Mm-hmm. Maybe just because of features of our world, but maybe just because of features of humans. So it's not exactly there is an environmentalist wing of antinatalism, like the human extinction movement. They're pretty funny. That's not my, yeah, some of them do, some of them pretty cool. The Church of Euthanasia, those guys from the,
right.
Chris. My branch is the more, philanthropic side. So this is a little different from the child free people who maybe just think children are gross and think And there do seem to be some happiness losses based on the research from having children. There's supposedly a corresponding gain in the sense of meaning. So I don't want to say that's an entirely wrong choice from a personal perspective without considering the rights of children. My concern is more with the right not to be born.
Yeah, I want to return to meaning shortly, but it seems that you extend this idea of suffering, if I read you correctly, beyond the human realm and into the non-human realm, into non-human organisms. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Humans have a particular kind of suffering because we have a self-aware sense of self that is sort of imagined from the perspective of others. So we have this very well-developed sense of shame and all kinds of status-based suffering that goes with that. But down to even crustaceans and probably insects, there's the capacity for pain. I'm not a vegan or anything, but there is so much suffering in nature, not even just the factory farms. Animals hunting each other in nature. You know, imagine you're running from something that's going to eat you, and then it eats you alive. the the birds that sort of kill a number of their children, slowly starve them to death because they can only have a couple. They have a large litter, so they have spares, and then starve some of them to death, or have them, you know, like the pelicans, they fight to the death to one chick after having three. There's all kinds of, you know, parasitic animals that the parasitic wasps that mind control various other insects, and nature's, it's almost like nature's joking, like, how can it be that horrible? I don't think life is good for animals. I don't know about plants. Plants seem pretty okay. But
maybe that's only because we can't understand them yet.
And I wonder about that. Because I'm sure any plant that I've tried to take care of has screamed at various times. I'm not very good with plants.
Well, and then so, there's infanticide that is practiced by several species, including cranes, for example. So through evolution, cranes have developed the capacity to have two or three animals in each clutch, in each set of eggs.
Yeah.
But then very promptly, they kill all except one.
Yeah.
This gives killing and eating your children a whole new meaning.
Yeah. And humans, I believe humans have the highest rate of infanticide among the great apes. Hmm. So we also have sort of more spares than we need.
Yeah.
I mean, not anymore, probably, but throughout evolutionary history, probably.
We're number one.
We're number one, right. As far as the human experience in suffering, is suffering inherently bad, or is it something that we and how we react to it?
Yeah, I think it is inherently bad. That's almost by the name of it. It's almost sort of a tautology. Does it all have to be equally bad? No, and I think there's some kinds of suffering that are worse than others. I'd mentioned the human capacity for perceiving the self from the perspective of others, and the shame and guilt that goes with that. That can probably be mitigated by various social rituals, various ways of that people have of being together. You'd mentioned meaning. I think finding meaning can sort of palliate suffering, almost like a drug, but in maybe a more positive way. That's very hard to do individually. So that's something I think people creating meaning and finding meaning together is more psychologically valuable than trying to do that just by yourself. We kind of need each other, and that gives us, you know, kind of a reason to be there for each other. And that's another, I think, sense of meaning, is just being able to take care of other people.
You mentioned earlier, you touched upon sacredness, and I was wondering, there's an excellent section in your book that you write about sacredness, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and some of the things that we probably overlook as a species that are considered really sacred by us.
Yeah, the psychologist Jonathan Haidt writes about that. I think he's great. His famous quotation is, in politics, but this kind of applies to everything, if you want to find the sacredness, look for the ring of motivated ignorance.
Yeah.
That this idea that sacredness, when we have a sacred value, that's great, and that's part of meaning, right, is treating certain things, certain concepts. But it also blinds us to things like we just can't even conceive of certain ideas because they violate sacredness. Haidt's mantra in his book is sacredness binds and blinds, that it binds us together. It's how we sort of do social cognition together, but it also makes things difficult to think about clearly. It blinds us to certain arguments and possibilities. You definitely see that in politics. Anytime you're sort of angrily arguing with someone, it's usually because both you and them are having sacredness violations, that your sense of sacredness is being violated by them. You have somehow violated their sense of sacredness. You're not really talking on the same level, or you're not really having a cool, calm conversation. And it's really difficult. And I think being a troll like me, you really do hurt people's feelings, and I feel bad about that. So I try to limit my reach to people who are interested in it and can handle it and aren't going to be upset by it, because I do think sacredness violations hurt, and they do matter. So I don't go out of my way to try to upset people with that stuff. Same with politics.
Well, on the other hand, some sacredness isn't sacred to other people, right?
Exactly.
So your sacredness might insult me, you know, if you think it's sacred to practice infanticide with my children. I might find that offensive.
Indeed. Yeah, and it's difficult to agree on sort of a set of values. We have this sort of Enlightenment idea that, or sort of libertarian maybe idea that we each have our own province, and whatever's sacred to you, that's fine, as long as it doesn't bother me. I think it's hard to do peopling that way. It's hard to be together as human beings that way. It's a puzzle, and there's no easy solution to it.
Now, it seems to me that, at least in the work Guy and I do in the things we talk about, the big sacred item for us is civilization. We talk a great deal about civilization on this show and what it means, our living arrangement, and what it is doing to the planet, not only us, but what supports everything in life in general. And so when we bring up the idea of not just challenging capitalism, which most people that are progressive can get to that point, but then we point out where capitalism came from, and the root of capitalism, and we point to civilization, they can't even fathom it, because it's something that's just a given. Like, how else are we supposed to possibly live? And so that, I think for us, that's where the sacredness comes to play, at least what I've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think communism also comes from civilization. generally associated with giant mass graves. And one of my friends says market is a horrible way to distribute goods, except for everything else, which is something people say about democracy. I'm not a big fan of democracy. I think it tends toward totalitarianism. I'm not sure that the changes in political systems around the late 18th century were overall benefit. I think I am one of those people. I don't know how we would live and support everybody without capitalist markets, especially agriculture. Horrifying my mother right now.
Well, the shorter answer is we wouldn't support everyone, and that's
exactly
part of the,
there would be a mass die-off, despite my politics, I don't support or think would be a good thing.
No, and we may not have that choice down the road either. Adding 235,000 mm-hmm. people to the planet minus births or deaths every day, so
yeah,
it may not be our decision shortly.
Yeah.
Right. I'm guessing you don't have children.
No, I don't have children. I have many friends who have children. They have excellent children.
Right. No, Some of my best friends are children.
Yeah.
So did you assume your antinatalist stance before or after you made that decision to have children? Or do you remember?
To not have children? I think I was at least open to the idea until maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And then... reading Benatar's book and thinking about some other things. My husband feels the same, so there wasn't conflict there when we got together.
Well, that's convenient.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing the math right, you're in your mid-30s. Is that about right?
I'm 37.
Uh-huh. And a lot of people, in fact, the statistics indicate that people who wait to have children... There's a greater probability that they won't have children, and if
exactly.
they do, they'll have fewer children. And
exactly.
so your own personal situation sort of fits that statistical bent anyway.
Yeah, and some people, I think, don't necessarily make the choice intentionally. They just sort of wait too long, and maybe they didn't want to have kids, but they waited too long. But yeah, that's not the case with us.
Right. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Guy McPherson, along with Michael Sliva. We're interviewing Sarah Perry, author of Every Cradle is a Grave. Sarah also blogs at theviewfromhell.blogspot.com. We're taking your calls today. Toll free, give us a ring at 888-874-4888. Sarah, you write about finding meaning. Do you find meaning in your life, and what does that even mean to you?
I'm still searching for meaning. My peculiar brain, I think I find meaning through intellectual investigation, sort of trying to find out the answer to the next little mystery, trying to find the next little insight. Almost like a drug addict or a shopping addict wanting the next little thing or the next hit of it. That's maybe my biggest source of meaning. My marriage definitely is, has been a huge source of meaning and a sense of calm, I guess, for the past few years. I don't have a strong sense of meaning. One of my friends is a Buddhist scholar and writes under the handle Meaningness we're kind of all working on the same problem, I think, of how do people who have a really hard time with belief find meaning. And one of my answers has been investigating ritual, that meaning is not so much just about deciding to believe in this particular principle or something, but more about practice, and that religious belief actually is less important than religious practice. And even weirder, religious practice probably causes religious belief. So it's almost as if you go to church and hang out with the people, whatever it is, or you know, go to fellowship, whatever it is, do the rituals, probably you'll end up believing about the same as the people around you. So that's one strategy. Not that I've really accomplished this, but I think it might work.
Well, yeah, it's a self-reinforcing feedback loop of its own. The more you go, the more you hang out with people who have similar beliefs, and those beliefs start to rub off on you, or at least if they don't, you find yourself as something of an outcast from the general group.
And also, in a more positive way, doing the rituals signals to yourself that this is something important. So it sort of convinces you that it really is something important. Why would I be doing these rituals if I didn't really believe this? So
yeah, true.
And it can be fun. I mean, it doesn't have to be boring and lame.
Right. Do you think meaning is important? Do you think finding meaning is important? I mean, Nietzsche was not exactly anti-nihilism. Especially towards the end of his career.
I think it's not so much important as it's just necessary and going to happen. I think it's really hard to be human and be an actual denier of all meaning. That almost becomes its own meaning. I think it's you'd have to be a complete hermit, and also not have any other people in your head in the sense of thinking about people. I think it would be really hard to live without meaning for long. I don't think anybody accomplishes it for long. It sucks when we do. I think there's a stage, especially after a major loss or in a major depression period, where people are separated from meaning. This is a one of Roy Baumeister's analyses. Where people are living in a really a sort of disconnected way, where they're not thinking of their lives as a narrative. They're sort of just going through the motions, not connecting what they're doing to any kind of meaning, trying to shut off thought. And I don't think that tends to last for long. It's probably a protective mechanism because it's just too horrible to reconnect up your life after a major loss. It's almost our brains protecting us from seeing the horrible truth too soon. And then gradually people connect more of their activities with a sense of meaning. It doesn't always work, approximately 1% of deaths are suicides. I don't think it's some trivial thing that, oh, everything will be okay for everybody. But I do think it's just genuinely, as a practical matter, difficult to live without meaning for long.
Did you, you know, in the search for, because it's not exactly what I would call a happy-go-lucky book. I enjoyed it a great deal. But so did you have trouble finding a publisher?
I had been in contact. Richard Smith in West Virginia is the publisher of Nine Banded Books. We had been friends for a long time. He and his wife had visited us when we lived in L.A., and he had actually was the one who told me to write the book, so who gradually got it out, a chapter at a time. He's a really neat guy. He's a vegan and has a bunch of cats and just publishes some really interesting books, kind of thought crimey books that nobody else will publish. Everyone will find something that he publishes shocking. So, but really, really nice, honest person. So I was happy to publish with Nine Banded Books.
Excellent. Yeah. So, I looked through the reading list and boy, there's some really, really interesting titles.
Yeah. If you're not shocked, then you have something wrong with you.
So I don't want you to speak for him, or maybe I do. Does he publish some of these books for their value in terms of provocation?
I don't know. No, I don't think he publishes anything that he doesn't think it's important for people to read and be exposed to. I don't think he cares about like attention or stuff like that. I think it's out of a place of honesty.
Yeah. Okay. So there is a certain taboo against provocation in this culture. If it's if we think it's going to irritate or draw the ire or whatever for somebody, we sort of shy away. Mm-hmm. It sounds like he's not doing that.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
So
go ahead, Guy.
No, go ahead.
Okay. How about, and this is a question you may not want to necessarily address, but how about personal pushback from, you know, family, friends, relatives? I mean, Guy and I have some pretty radical views about things, and we've experienced, you know, mainly me from friendships, not so much family, and Guy can talk to his experiences, but has there been anything you wish to bring up or talk about, or?
I've been amazed that of how nice people are about it. As I said, I sort of expected more pushback and was almost, especially when the book was published, I like had a knot in my stomach, like, oh, what's going to happen? But, I haven't lost any friends. My, my family's, they're proud. They're interested. And yeah, it's.
Sounds like you have some more work to do.
You need to dig a little deeper, Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah, I have to go pretty far to horrify people.
So that brings up a good question. What challenges do you find with your work?
Let's see. One challenge I have, and this is, so I've been writing for a blog called Ribbon Farm for about a year. That's more, what am I even writing about? Ritual, social psychology, life as a joke, stuff like that. One problem I have with writing, I'm so afraid of pedantic corrections, like little nitpicky things, that it's almost difficult to say things clearly and concisely, that it's a struggle to just spill it out, say, you know, provocative, clear, concise things, because you know there's some, the whole internet is full of little nitpicky pedants, and I'm one of them. I'm totally like, oh, somebody's wrong, you're wrong in this particular tiny way that has nothing to do with your main. So I understand the urge, but I'm also afraid of it, and maybe I'm afraid of it because that's, you know, it's inside me.
So did it take you a long time to finish the book because of that?
Yeah, and... Yeah. Yeah, I just published a paper in a science book, so it's on psychopathology of evolution of psychopathology, And I'm kind of terrified of that one that I have, you know, it has like 60 citations, but like know I made some stupid error. And I'm an independent scholar. I'm not kind of held to the same standards, but yeah, publishing actual science feels like I'm asking for trouble.
Yes, I promise you're asking for trouble. especially if it's science that challenges the way people think about the world, if it challenges their worldview even at a relatively small level.
Yeah, even when I'm citing somebody's work and they don't like what I'm saying, it can be like, but your exact paper says that.
Right, I've had similar experiences.
Yeah.
So, what inspires you? How do you keep going beyond your marriage, your family, your friends? You have written recently for this science book. Are you inspired to dig a little deeper, to always keep niggling away at those issues that other people seem unwilling to take on?
Yeah, and usually every few weeks or every month or so, I find some interesting question to work on. Just reading a lot, having friends who are good trolls who can troll me into finding something interesting to think about. Running, I'm very much addicted to running. I think I recently read a study that most people, when they're running, their main thought is about being in pain, which I don't even understand. It's the most pleasurable, addictive experience. I feel like, if people just sort of slowed down and paid attention to making it feel good, it would.
I'm a runner as well.
It would have a better reputation, yeah.
I do a fair amount of running. In fact, I'm going to go for my run after this interview. But
awesome.
My experience is in two part. I have two running careers, as I call them. My running as a youth, when I was running in high school and college, was very much pain. And
suffering. I hated it. I did not enjoy it. Yeah.
And then I left it for about 20 years and came back to it about 4 years ago. And I wholeheartedly agree with what you just said. I enjoy it so much more. And I think because I'm paying attention to it and not just grinding through it.
Exactly. Yeah. How can I get the most possible pleasure from this next step?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's true. So
it's almost as if you're, you know, living in the moment or something silly like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what's next? Is there a follow-up book in your future? Have you moved on to different topics? Are you sticking with this sort of thing? Or
I have kind of moved on. I mean, all my topics are kind of related, and I have this sort of mental map that's just a mess of everything. That it's all connected in a million different places. And I think my intellectual style is more connecting things together rather than sort of generating data, or it's models that connect different ideas together. So yeah, my next big project is probably going to be on ritual, how ritual functions as costly signaling, some social psychology stuff. I'm interested in the theory of humor and how that relates to human consciousness.
Right on. We'll do it.
Yeah, that sounds great. You mentioned this paper in the science book. Is it out? When can we look forward to seeing that? And what's the title of the book?
It is. I don't know off the top of my head. Darn it. Sorry.
Sorry, you can email it to us. We can post
it. Okay. You. Yeah, sure. Great. Yeah, because I really want more people reading it and finding errors.
The work
I've been most proud of the past year is on ribbonfarm.com, which is Venkatesh Rao's blog that I'm a contributing editor of. And I write every month for Ribbon Farm, and I have done some pretty interesting stuff this year. One of the best ones I call the essence of peopling. Peopling is a verb, is in how people. And that's about our particular human consciousness and how we're different from animals, where our particular forms of suffering come from, and also our opportunities for fun.
And that sounds great.
That's pretty awesome.
I haven't seen many posts on the view from hell.
Yeah, I've kind of moved to Ribbon Farm, and I have a couple others that I post to. I have a WordPress one and a group blog that I post to. So.
Okay.
Well, Sarah, thank you for your time. We really enjoyed
the
interview.
Thank you, guys.
We do have a question from John.
Oh, yeah,
Before we let you go, Sarah, maybe the question's for you. John, are you with us?
I'm here. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to apologize. My call is a little off topic. So, if you don't have to answer right now, you can answer it another time or, you know, on your website. Did you want to take the call?
Sure.
Okay. Yes.
My question is, do both of you gentlemen think that, you know, with everything occurring and, you know, emissions and so on and so forth and just the way things are going, do you think, for lack of a better term, the world should have ended already? I guess what I'm driving at is I've accepted the fact that, you know, where we're headed. I guess I just, you know, thinking about possibilities that there could be, you know, some outside actor, you know, God or, you know, aliens or, you know, not to sound stupid, but do you think that things should have ended already? And do you think there's even a very slight possibility that there could be some outside actor preventing this from occurring right now, or even nuclear war, or so on and so forth? Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, John. Sarah, you want to take that one?
Well, there's a non-supernatural answer that there is something preventing, in a sense, not causally, but the anthropic argument that the fact that we're here, there's millions of other possible civilizations that don't exist because they've been destroyed or prevented from existing. We're the one that exists. The fact that we're talking on the radio now means all of the possibilities aligned correctly. So it's not a causal explanation, but it's an interesting thing to think about, the anthropic, I don't know what the noun is, argument, conclusion. I love that there's a Twitter account called Sweet Meteor of Death who's running for president. And it's basically a giant meteor that's going to hit the Earth in 2016, and he's trying to explain like why his policies are the best. And I'm pretty pleased with this Twitter account. I like this mod.
Follow that guy.
He's like, somebody tweets like, everyone needs a policy to address racial injustice, and Smod is like, I have a policy.
Kaboom!
Exactly.
The one size fits all policy.
Yeah. Right. I think humor is a healthy way to deal with our sorrow and anxiety, and I like his particular way of dealing with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
All right. Well, on that note, thank you, Sarah. You can find Sarah's book, Every Cradle Is a Grave. If you go to Nine Banded Books, you can buy it there, and I'm sure you can find it anywhere else where you can order books. And thank you for your time, Sarah.
Thank you, guys. Nice to meet you.
Thank you, Sarah. It's a pleasure.
All right, Guy, you got a climate update?
Yes. First, I want to address John's question. Okay. I don't think there is a should. I think we should avoid shoulds. There's just what is, and we know that what is here. Anyway, that's just my rambling off the top of my head.
That's not helping me at all. I feel bad now.
Okay, for those of us still with us today, I do have a climate change update. A paper in the January 4th, 2016 online edition of Nature Geoscience finds, quote, lakes and ponds are a dominant methane source at high northern latitudes. By compiling previously reported measurements made at a total of more than 700 northern water bodies, the researchers have been able to more accurately estimate emissions at a large scale. They found that that methane emissions from lakes and ponds alone are equivalent to roughly two-thirds of all the natural methane sources in the northern region. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 28. Methane is being released from beneath Antarctic ice, as was reported in a 2012 paper in Nature. This third primary source of methane, in addition to permafrost and the shallow seabed, potentially is enormous. And it's not just Antarctica spewing methane hydrates from beneath the ice. Ice sheets may be hiding vast reservoirs in the Arctic, too, as reported in the January 7th, 2016 issue of Nature Communications. I'll quote from the abstract. Here we synthesize observations of about 1,900 fluid escape features, pockmarks, and active gas flares across a previously glaciated Arctic margin. Our results indicate that even under conservative estimates of ice thickness with temperate subglacial conditions, a 500-meter thick gas hydrate stability zone existed beneath the ice sheet. Moreover, we revealed that in water depths 150 to 520 meters, methane release also persisted through a 20-kilometer-wide window between the subsea and subglacial gas hydrate stability zone. This window expanded in response to post-glacial climate warming and deglaciation, therefore opening the Arctic shelf for methane release.
In other words,
I generally try to translate the scientific language of referee journals into plain spoken English. In this particular case, here's the translation. We're screwed. Really, totally screwed. It's unimaginably worse than I previously indicated. I've added this information to feedback number 7. I could go on, but I think that covers it pretty well. Further evidence of the conservative nature of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is revealed by a paper in the January 8, 2016 issue of Journal of Geophysical Research Oceans. This paper focused on warming of the Northwest Atlantic Ocean. Quote, the IPCC fifth assessment of projected global and regional ocean temperature change is based on global climate models that have coarse ocean and atmosphere resolutions. Here we compare simulations and an atmospheric CO2 doubling response from four global climate models of varying ocean and atmosphere resolution. We find that the highest resolution climate model resolves Northwest Atlantic circulation and water mass distribution most accurately. The CO2 doubling response from this model shows that upper ocean temperature in the Northwest Atlantic shelf warms at a rate nearly twice as fast as the coarser models and nearly three times faster than the global average. So yet again, the term faster than expected comes into play. In fact, there's a new blog this year called fasterthanexpected.com. It describes itself with the following introduction. Search for faster than expected in your favorite search engine, and you'll find many results related to climate change. The glaciers are melting faster than expected. Sea level rises rising faster than expected. Permafrost is melting faster than expected. The list goes on. We see these results so often, we decided to start collecting them here to serve as a diary of sorts, a diary of the end of life as we know it on this beautiful planet Earth we call home. So I'd recommend checking that out, fasterthanexpected.com.
I must read.
Yeah. Even bacteria are negatively affected by ocean acidification. According to a paper in the January 11th, 2016 issue of Nature Climate Change, these minuscule organisms function as the wastewater treatment plants of the ocean. At the same time, bacteria help release nutrients such as food and phosphorus, which are essential to the food chain, and ocean acidification is wiping them out. A paper published in the January 12, 2016 edition of Nature Communications shows that clouds are playing a much larger role than previously understood in heating the Greenland ice sheet. Clouds trap heat, thus accounting for as much as 30% of the ongoing melt of the ice sheet. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 6. People who believe in weather manipulation via chemtrails and HAARP, take note. If you really believe we can manipulate the weather, don't you think we'd be doing it? In this case, we'd be creating cloudy days to reflect sunlight and clear nights to allow the heat to escape. This would retain ice in the Arctic and Greenland, which might allow habitat for our species to persist beyond a few more years. But nobody is doing that because there's no way for us to manipulate the weather at that sort of scale, contrary to the inexplicable nonsense spewed by the chemtrail crowd. On the topic of the spread of deadly disease, a paper in the January 18th, 2016 online issue of Trends in Parasitology includes the following lines in the abstract. And I challenge you to find another radio program that quotes from Trends in Parasitology when talking about abrupt climate change. But I'll connect these dots shortly. Here's the quote from the abstract. Intensification of food production has the potential to drive increased disease prevalence in food plants and animals. Microsporidia are diversely distributed, opportunistic, and density-dependent parasites infecting hosts from almost all known animal taxa. They are frequent in highly managed aquatic and terrestrial hosts, many of which are vulnerable to epizootics, and all of which are crucial for the stability of the animal-human food chain. Mass rearing and changes in global climate may exacerbate disease and more efficient transmission of parasites. strong evidence exists for an increasing prevalence of microsporidiosis in animals and humans, and for sharing pathogens across hosts and biomes.
In other words,
we're spreading disease in the food chain. I was teaching the accelerated spread of deadly disease resulting from anthropogenic climate change in my courses nearly two decades ago. The journal literature is catching up, albeit slowly. And I detest journal articles that differentiate humans from other animals. When they write something like increasing prevalence of microsporidiosis, okay, I got a problem already, in animals and humans as if humans aren't animals, that really irritates me. Okay. A paper published on January 18th, that's yesterday, 2016, online edition of Nature Climate Change, found that more than 90% of the heat trapped by greenhouse gas pollution since the 1970s has wound up in the oceans, and a little more than a third of that seafaring heat has worked its way down to depths greater than 2,300 feet. In fact, nearly half of the increases in ocean temperature between 1865 and 2015 occurred in just the past 20 years, a rate that is steadily getting quicker. This is the exponential function expressing itself in the heating of the ocean, with the energy equivalent of four Hiroshima-style nuclear bombs being exploded every second since 1997. The final line from the paper's abstract reads, and I quote, "Nearly half of the industrial era increases in ocean heat content have occurred in recent decades, with over a third of the accumulated heat occurring below 700 meters and steadily rising." CBS News reported on this article yesterday. Their story included an interview with Kevin Trenberth, the climate analysis chief at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. He was not involved in this study. Trenberth has been looking at ocean heat content, and he said his ongoing work shows the team who conducted this research study, quote, significantly underestimates, end quote, how much heat the ocean has absorbed. Trenberth has always been quite conservative in his approach and with his language. For him to point out the conservative nature of this study is quite an admission.
Thank you, Guy. Well, that about wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Angie Cordero. If you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher and rate us on iTunes. And please share the link to the show if you can. Thanks again to our guest, Sarah Perry, and also to Afrozin for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last. There we go.